So, you know that expression, the canary in the coal mine? Well, back in 1911, British coal companies actually employed two canaries for each pit, and they were used as an early warning sign for miners. It was only 30 years ago that the practice was abandoned, but a metaphor was cemented. Well, on this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we are trading in the canaries for seabirds, and we're asking, will they be the early warning sign that'll save our oceans? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and this is the show where some of the University of Oxford's brightest minds tackle the big questions in science. You know, the ones that change the way we understand the world as we know it. And over the course of this series, we're going to be exploring a lot of different areas of science. But in this episode, we're starting at the seaside. We're walking through the Farlington Marshes, conveniently located next to the hum of the A27 near Portsmouth, with Dr. Annette Faye, who has developed a very special relationship with the Manx shearwater.
Oh, I love these birds because they're just completely incredible. They're beautiful and they're quite small, but they're fascinating.
Annette is a part of the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford, and she spends a lot of time with these seabirds, which she says looks like a very small albatross.
They are capable of really pretty incredible feats. So for example, all the birds from the colonies migrate to the same place, and they go to the Patagonian shelf off the coast of Argentina every year. So they breed in the UK, cross the Atlantic, spend the winter there, cross the Atlantic back, and come back to breed along the UK coast in Wales and Scotland. Somehow they are able to find their way there. We don't really know how seabirds navigate at sea over such large distances, but clearly they're able to do it, and they come back every year after year. And they can live till pretty long. I mean, the average lifespan of a Manx shearwater is about 30 years, but the UK record holder at the moment is 53. So the sheer number of kilometres they just fly over their lifetime is incredible. And we calculated that a shearwater living to 50 years old might actually migrate enough time to cover a distance sufficient to fly to the moon and back, which for a 400-gram small bird the size of a small crow is pretty incredible.
Over the past 2 years, Annette has been studying the breeding season of the Manx shearwater as they nest on Skomer Island in Wales. It's a pretty remote spot that just has a very basic house on it with a tiny bit of internet and electricity. Other than that, it is pretty untouched. So it is the perfect spot for Annette and other researchers to stay as they study the birds. Now, the thing about the Manx shearwater is that it's nocturnal. In the 11th century, Vikings thought this bizarre noise they were making were trolls or evil spirits.
You go out at night and there's just birds flying everywhere.
But for Annette, this sound, it's her alarm clock from a colony of 300,000 pairs. It's time for her to get up and start her day taking a closer look at how the birds raise their young.
I want you to see how the effort they spend rearing a chick every year affect their future behaviour, non-breeding behaviour, so migrating, wintering, and also their future breeding. So I wanted to artificially expand or shorten their breeding season to see how or whether that affected what they did next, so next migration, wintering, and the breeding the following year, to see whether all these events in the annual cycle are linked.
Manx shearwaters nest in burrows, and they only lay a single egg each year. They also, conveniently, don't recognize their chicks. They just see a tiny bird chirping for food. And so, when Annette swapped younger for older chicks from different nests, the parents didn't even notice.
They continued feeding the chick as normal, and actually, they responded to the chick's needs. So, the birds which had a chick which was bigger than their own fed it for less long, and then when the chicks was ready to fledge, they just stopped feeding it and it fledged. And so they finished breeding earlier than planned. And on the other group, so the birds which received a younger chick and had to feed it for longer, did feed it until it was ready. So they extended their breeding period and so delayed their own migration and prioritized the chick.
Annette tagged the birds before they migrated from the UK to Argentina so that she could keep track of them. And then, the following year, she found that their devotion to the chicks came at a cost to the parents. She says by leaving a week later than normal, it made them weaker the next year.
It may be the timing of migration may be very important because you want to probably make the best of certain weather, certain wind conditions, for example, to do these long journeys, but also avoid bad weather conditions. So it's probably a trade-off between you want to leave on time, but you want to continue feeding your chick. And so what we found is that these birds were leaving later after having fed a chick for longer. And so they were a bit late in migration. They arrived at the wintering ground later. And overall, because they're starting the return migration in spring at the same time as other birds, overall they had a shorter period spent at the wintering ground where there is all this productive food.
Seabirds like the Manx shearwater are key indicators of what's happening to our oceans. In September, the International Union for Conservation of Nature released a report saying that the soaring temperature of our oceans is the greatest hidden challenge of our generation. The report also says that the upper few meters of the oceans have warmed by around 0.13 degrees Celsius a decade since the start of the 20th century, and that they expect that temperature will rise 1 to 4 degrees by the end of this century. Now, if you look at how seabirds find food, migrate, and yes, breed, you can get a better sense of what's happening in the water as these changes occur. And while Annette has studied just one type of bird, she says her findings could be revealing of what's happening to other species around the world.
I think the coolest thing that we learned, basically every decision in their lives will have an effect on what's happening next. So all the events in their lives are linked, may it be migration or wintering or breeding. It's all a big cycle, and any decision, any use of resources in one year will have an effect on the future years. I think what is difficult to answer is that if it becomes harder for the birds to breed, and if there are, for example, fewer resources and they have to work harder, then yes, it is possible that the birds will then be caught in this vicious cycle of having a bad year, spending lots of effort breeding, and then having a difficult winter as a result, and then having problems the following year, and it might be some sort of knock-on effect year after year. But we haven't really studied that in detail yet, but it is possible that this may happen.
Armed with this knowledge, Annette wants to expand her work. Up until recently, a lot of the information gathered about seabirds has been observational, and that's just because we didn't have the technology to keep up with them as they migrated around the world.
Year after year, the devices that we deploy on them get smaller and record more and more things. So now we can even start deploying devices such as dive loggers, which record how deep they dive and what sort of prey they eat. And we can also now deploy small accelerometers, which measure all their movements in 3D. So we can really start understanding how they use winds and waves and the weather in general to navigate and to fly over such long distances and calculate the energy expenditure of such long journeys. I mean, there's so much more that needs to be discovered.
And so if researchers have more data and they'll be able to see exactly what problems the birds are running into, whether it's finding food or migrating or, as Annette's study looked at, breeding, then they're also getting a chance to look at how the oceans are coping with such dramatic changes in the environment.
Seabirds are a very important group of birds, and they're actually the most threatened group of birds at the moment. I think it's about 28% of seabirds are endangered or threatened, and so it's important that we learn more about them to be able to protect them. And not just because we want to protect seabirds because we like them, but because they're top marine predators. They are very good indicators of the ocean health. What needs to be done is some long-term studies need to be done, because obviously you can't just study a population one year and make big conclusions about what's going on. But for example, by following these birds year after year and looking at how they change, or weather and how they change their behavior with, for example, the warming waters and climate change and the changes in wind condition and currents in the ocean, we can learn how we're affecting the ocean, but also obviously looking at the prey. So if they struggle to finding prey because the preys have moved up north, for example, because the waters are warming, or if they're just less available because there's been overfishing, we can really learn a lot about how the ocean is changing by just looking at these birds.
And so for researchers like Annette, seabirds are taking on the prophetic canary in the coal mine metaphor. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks, with music by John Lyons. A special thanks to Dr. Annette Faye, Laura Mechan-Esherwood, and Petrel's Night and Day, a sound approach guide by Magnus Robb, Killian Malarney, and The Sound Approach for these lovely sounds of the Manx Shearwater. And if that sound does not inspire you to tweet, I don't know what will. Tell us what you think of this podcast. Go to Twitter. We're at Oxford Sparks. You can also find us on Facebook. And of course, you can find a lot of other cool stuff by going to the website oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. I'm Emily Elias. And until next time on the podcast, when we ask, is your bacon sandwich really gonna kill you? Bye for now.